Okay. All righty. Hi, I'm Dove, and today's call is brought to you by a question from a person who's on the call. What do I do about continuous relapsing? And there are many great talks on SA websites and probably on other recovery websites, probably AA websites. There are a lot of apps you can get on your phone and websites that you can look at that have many, many great recordings from people in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and in and DA, Debtors Anonymous, or NA, Narcotics Anonymous, or SA, Sexaholics Anonymous, or other groups, where they talk, and OA also probably has a lot of great recordings of sober people who have been through the merry-go-round themselves, and they share really great stuff on what to do about chronic relapsing. In particular, there's a person who I'm not going to give you any names. Just you have to try out. My experience has been that I just try out different speakers. You give them 10 minutes, and you just listen for 10 minutes, and you see, is this person addressing my issue at all? Are they interesting? Maybe they're not addressing it yet, but they're going to get to it. And I like the direction that they're going. It's refreshing and different to me. So maybe I'll learn something from this, you know? So that I would highly recommend listening to AA speakers and SA speakers and other 12-step group speakers in talks that that have this as the topic, chronic relapsing. I'd like to address a few things for you and for me on this. First off, I want to just say that the general answer to what do I do about chronic relapsing is really the question, is changing the question to how do I get serious about the program, which of course the answer to that is pain, and there's no other answer, period. If I have pain, there are only two motivators for human beings, pain and pleasure. There aren't really any other motivators. When you say, well, I want to do what's right, so you're talking either about pain from doing what's wrong that you're sick of, or the pleasure of being a good person and knowing that you're being helpful to your husband, wife, family, you know, Jewish people, God, whatever it is. That's kind of, it's one or the other, you know, to me. And I don't think that's a bleak look at humanity or life. I think it's kind of obvious, really. And it doesn't mean that you're getting a kick out of it necessarily. It's not like, you know, Rabbi Akiva wasn't motivated simply because every time he learned the Mishnah from his Rebbe, he would, like, get this, you know, zing of pleasure, and his serotonin or melatonin or whatever would start getting, you know, like in his brain, and he gets, like, pleasure. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about feeling good. Not pleasure, per se, necessarily, but just feeling good about yourself. And if a person does what they think is right, if you're true to yourself and you do what you think is right, then you might not feel tremendous pleasure right away, but you'll feel better about yourself, and you'll notice after a while, hey, I haven't felt horrible. I haven't had a miserable day in a couple of weeks now. This is pretty amazing. Or yesterday, I didn't feel miserable pretty much the whole day, and that's an unusual thing. I'm usually feeling miserable a good amount of the time. So it could be something like that. I consider that pleasure versus pain. You know, so it's not just like the mindfulness Skinner-based CBT people would kind of look at it, that it's a zing of pleasure versus a stab of pain, and you're like an animal in a rat maze getting trained by reward and punishment. I don't think that's That's not the way I'm looking at it. I'm looking at it in a much more general way that I think real human beings operate, as opposed to like dogs, you know? So that's one thing. Pain is the motivator. Pleasure is the motivator. And if a person feels like, I masturbate, so I'll go to hell later and I'll boil and this and that and who knows what. Moloch will smash my eyes in the kever and these other mimarim that people try to scare the hell out of you with. And, you know, you go, okay, but right now, man, does this orgasm feel great? You know, so like, obviously they're not going to do very well, you know? So if that's what you're trying to work on and you feel like I have an emunah problem, so you have to work on Gehenna and Gan Eden and think in those terms and do exercises and maybe beat yourself or something, I don't know. So, I mean, you're obviously going down a wacky track that's not going to lead to good things. On the other hand, if you start focusing on your relationship with the Rabbona Shel Olam and growing up, I'm saying this from a religious perspective, if you start working more on your relationship with the Rabbona Shel Olam and on growing up and being a mensch, because, you know, Derech Eretz Kodmah LaTorah, you know, and like, how are you going to be frum if you're still a baby? You know, you're a baby. You're not a bar mitzvah yet. You're a baby. So, you know, so if that's what your focus is on, growing up and fixing the relationships, getting the relationships with God right, let's say, so then you're probably going on a better track and you'll feel better and, you know, and that's probably what God wants from you more than thinking about imagery of you burning in hell, you know, and whatever. So, the question, of course, on that path is, how do you get serious about the Rabbona Shel Olam? Do you open up Zifrei Emuna and, you know, Chasko Levenstein talk about Emuna Bechush and Emuna and Emuna and Emuna? Or do you say to yourself, you know, I've been learning in Yeshiva for 17 years, or I've read 15 million Sfarim on Emuna, and I've been in, you know, this and that, and I'm a firm person, and, like, what's going on? Do I have to learn yet another Sefer and another Sefer and another Sefer? Or do you say, something, maybe I'm missing some of the building blocks, you know? And it's more likely that if you've been trying for a long time and it's not working, that you're missing some of the building blocks. So the building blocks are generally in relationships, are self-honesty, which you don't learn from being honest with yourself, because you're using your own sicko brain to figure out whether you're honest to yourself or not, and that doesn't work. Self-honesty is learned by being honest with other people, generally, in my opinion. So if you have other people that you're actually being honest with, like fully, fully honest with, on a continuing basis, not just making a tremendous show of willpower and like telling all and it's like a one time and then you hang up, or, you know, you post something about yourself, oh my God, I did it, and then you leave. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about creating a relationship where you tell the truth, and then, and even though you told the truth, you continue the relationship with that person. Yeah, I'm just stopping because it's a stop sign. So are you the kind of person, okay, are you the kind of person that, excuse me for just a second, do I need her to take me? So I should wake her up and have her take me. Okay. You go to this door? Okay. No. Oh, if you can call her now, that would be awesome. It's not your job. Yeah, it's my job, not yours. Okay. I'd like to leave as soon as possible.
Around 9.
Yeah. Yeah, 9 the latest. 9 would be good. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. I just said goodbye to my wife. So a person who doesn't have the real building blocks to making real relationships will not succeed at working on his or her relationship with God. You just won't, because you don't have the kalim, because you haven't grown up yet in terms of relationships. This is why, and I keep coming back to this. This is why. Okay, if you can somehow quiet the kid down with like a large piece of fruit, that would be fantastic. I would recommend pears. Kids love pears. Anyway, I mean, I love pears and I'm a kid. So, but it's okay. Don't worry about the kid not really bothering us. If I just ignore it, everything would be fine. okay, so Now I'm hungry. Okay, so that's why Kabeiros Avicha Vesimecha is in the first set of the Luchos. The first Luchos are, the first five of the Luchos are Ben Adam Lamakom, between man and God. The second half of the Luchos are between man and man. This is obvious. Everybody learns this in school as children, as little kids. You learn this all the time. The common denominator between all the commandments in the first five are that they're between man and God, and the ones in the second five are all of us, are all similar in that they're between, you know, man and man. In other words, behavior of human beings to human beings. So the question is, why is Kabeiros Avicha Vesimecha in the first? It's the fifth commandment. Isn't it the fifth? I think it's the fifth. It's first commandment. Why is it in the first half of the Luchos? It's obviously being good to your parents isn't being good to God. You're not being good to God because you're being good to your parents any more than keeping kosher or not killing your fellow man. You're not killing your fellow man. You're not stealing. So that's also a mitzvah that Hashem tells you, but it's between people and people. Why is Kabeiros Avicha Vesimecha, honor your father and your mother, in the first of the five commandments? So the reason is simple, because how do you learn a relationship with God? You learn it from your parents. Your parents, they take care of you. They feed you so you don't die. They diaper you so you don't rot. And so that you're comfortable. They entertain you and show you love so that you know that you are important and that you matter. They teach you right from wrong. Like God does in the Torah, you know? So they're gods to you. To a little baby, there's no Ribono Shel Olam and Emuna and Brachas. It's all a joke. The kid's God is his mother, and then his father, and then his parents as a unit as he grows a little older, you know? And that's, you know, when you're three or four, you start to realize that it's both parents operating together if they're a healthy marriage. And they become a unit, you know, unified, Abba and Ima together. So you know, that's where you learn mitzvahs. That's where you learn obedience. That's where you learn love. Ahava and Yira are, Ahava is all the Zohar says, Ahava is the mitzvah of Ahavta Hashem, which is Kabeid, Es Avicha Vesimecha. Kibbut is all Ahava, by the way. If you look at the mitzvahs in Kibbut Avaim, all the mitzvahs, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch and Kibbut Avaim, all aspects of Kibbut Avaim are positive. They're actions. They're mitzvahs asay, so to speak. Stand up when they come in the room. Don't sit in his place. That's not kibbut. That's mora. Mora Eim V'av is that you don't sit in their place, that you don't interrupt them. You don't contradict them. You know? Kibbut Avaim is that you do things for them. You care for them first. You listen to what they say. It's a positive thing. You, whatever it is, you do their will, you know, etc. That's all positive. That's mitzvahs asay and mitzvahs los asay to God. So all the mitzvahs asay are ahava, v'ahavta shem Elokecha. All the mitzvahs los asay, the Zohar Kodesh says, is v'yareisa me'elokecha, is fearing God, meaning not he's afraid of God, but in awe of God, that I have to listen to him because he's the only act in town, you know, and he's got all the power and there's nothing else for me to do. That's mora of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Learned by a Jewish human from their Kibbut Avaim and their mora Eim V'av. That's where you learn mitzvos lo asay and los asay from. This is simple. Relationships. The relationship that a person has with his parents, how he learns to manipulate them for candy or for whatever as a child, that is how he or she will treat God as they grow up. That is how you treat God. You learned how to relate to God, how to listen or not listen from how you interacted with your parents. And there's no escape from that. And sometimes it's not so easy to see the similarity, but it's there, and there's no escape. Because that was your first experience with a God-like figure. And David HaMelech actually says in the pasuk, "Yom alayhi mokach, yom alayhi nafshi," just like I rely on the breast of my mother to, you know, for sustenance, I rely on you. And just like a baby lays in the arms of his mother and has no worries, I lay in your kaviyochel, in your, so to speak, arms. You know, oh God, that's what he's saying. Because how does he know that? Because he remembers what it was like as a child. Or he sees children and he sees them laying in the arms of their parent and realizing now everything's fine. And I realize that, you know what, everything's fine. You're in charge. So this is from the relationship with the parents. If a person was mistreated terribly by his parents and or has sick parents, then mentally ill parents, then the child will actually not learn a proper relationship with God and will be handicapped, not necessarily for life, because as an adult you can choose, but as a child you really can't. But as an adult, you can really choose. And that's our job, to choose and to grow, no matter what our relationship with our parents was. But that's where it comes from. And it's the same way with relationships with people. Friendships, you know, a lot of guys tell me, I can't stay sober. And I say, well, how's your shalom bias? And I don't mean sex. I mean, how's the shalom bias? Oh, that's great. We're so close. You know, and we're so good, and we're this and we're that. And I go, but do you tell your wife that you're masturbating, you know, sometimes after you have sex with her, and you're masturbating every, you know, that you're going to work and that you're looking at naked people having sex and this and that? I mean, are you telling your wife that, does she know any? No, that's like a whole double life that I have, and she doesn't know it. She's never known anything about it. I've been doing it before we were married, so I figured it's not her business. And it's like, okay, so you have a whole secret life. You know, or a partial secret life. So how close are you really? Stop lying to yourself, please. Be honest with yourself. You're so close and you have such great shalom bias because she doesn't know you. Okay? That's why you have such a great relationship, because you're not that close. She doesn't really know you. And as far as closeness and openness, you know as well as I do that you got closest to your wife more than in any way, or husband, in any way, shape, or form. By far, you got the closest together. That was the single thing that propelled your relationship into a much closer nantkeit. You know how? When on the fifth date you admitted to her that you're adopted, or when on the fifth date you admitted to her that your parents really are divorced and that it's a stepmother or this or that, and she didn't know, or that you have a problem with pornography or whatever it was, you know, or that you have six toes on your left foot, you know, and you can't hide it from her forever. You're going to get married. She's going to see that sixth toe. You might as well tell her on some date, but what are you going to do? Wait until the 15th date? But it's a horrible thing. She'll run away. You have six toes. And it's like, oh, you have a giant mole on your back. And it's like, oh no, it's like, you know, and it's in the shape of Africa, you know, so it's like, which is kind of cool. But anyway, so it's like, and when are you going to tell her? And then you went and you told her, you know, or him, you know, because there are women listening to this too, Baruch Hashem. So it's, you know, that's what got you closer. You know that when you revealed secrets about yourself, you got incredibly closer. It was now you and her against the world, or you and him against the world. It's like unbelievable what it did to your closeness, that you had a secret about each other, between each other. And then what happens usually when you would, all these guys tell me, when do I tell the girl about that? Whenever they do tell the girl, she invariably tells him, unless she runs away, which happens rarely, but it does happen occasionally. But when she doesn't, she always tells him big things about herself and her family that she was uncomfortable telling before, but because he opened up, she opened up. Because she opened up, he opened up. And that's the way it works in recovery, always. And that's the way it works with ourselves. So yes, being open and honest and telling those big secrets, that is what closeness is all about. That is what makes you closer. So saying, we have a wonderful relationship, except for this one area, you know, I've been stealing money at work for 15 years. I don't know how to tell my wife. Well, she doesn't know the truth about you. That's why you have a close relationship. You call that a close relationship? So reality check, you know. So getting back to the point, having a close relationship with God is going to come from having the kalim to have a close relationship. And if you don't have close relationships with the humans in your life, then you won't succeed at having a close relationship with the God in your life. Okay? It's just not going to happen. So that would be my first element of, how do I get success in the program? Well, relationships. Are you opening up truly about whatever, if let's say you're telling me in this question, I don't trust the people in my meeting to really say everything to them. What do I do to open up to them? The answer is, for God's sakes, open up to them. What are you asking me for? Openness and honesty happen because of vulnerability, not because you make sure that there's only one other person in the meeting and they're deaf so that they can't hear you anyway, and now I'm ready to... to have a true relationship with another person. And trust me, that's funny. If you're not trusting, if you can't find anyone that you can really trust in a sexaholics group where they're all sexaholics, or guard your eyes people admitting the truth about each other to each other, and you can't trust them with the truth, then who can you trust? Well, a therapist. Well, because that's a piece of meat. He's a doctor, or she's a doctor, or she that's not a real human being. You know that. That's why women can go to men gynecologists. And some women often do it. How do they do that? It's because they're just a piece of meat there, and they know it, and that's what they want. They don't want someone who's like a cousin. They're not going to go to a gynecologist who's a cousin, because that's too real. It's too real a person. They can't do that, and they don't, and they never do. So a real relationship isn't going to be found with a therapist. Real relationships are going to be found with real people, people who you can make friends with, people who you can help as well, people who relate and who are also vulnerable and also telling the truth about themselves. So how are you going to get close to God and get these steps to work? How are you going to take God seriously? By taking people seriously. How do you take people seriously? Well, by being open and real with them, not by being afraid of them. If you're afraid of people, and you can't open up to any people for real about the fact that you can't open up to people because you're afraid of them and you don't trust them, if you can't say that to the people, then you don't trust them, and then you don't trust God either, I guarantee it. On some level, the same relationship exists with God. You just don't know it because no one takes God seriously enough, because we don't see him, we don't smell him, we don't taste him, we don't touch him, we don't hear him. He's just an idea. 99.999% of the time in your life, no matter who you are. And that's what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said to his Talmidim. When they asked him for a bracha, he said, halavai, that you should take God as seriously as you take people. And they said, what? We're Tanoim. We're not the dregs of society. Why would you give us such a goofy bracha as that? And you're a tzaddik about to die. You're at the height of your power. Why would you want to give us such a goofball loser bracha? And he said, halavai, teda, sha'adam, oivar, averav, armor, blibo, bovachla, yirani, adam. That everybody who sins, meaning you, when you do something that's for you a sin, that's embarrassing, and you do it, it's because no one's around to see you. My God's watching you. You don't take God as seriously as you take people, and he's talking to Tanoim. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the greatest Tana in his door, and he was talking to his Talmidim. And he was telling them, you don't take God as seriously as you take people. You don't. Because you can't. Because you don't talk to him. You're not Nevi'im. You don't touch him. You don't smell him, taste him, see him move. You don't do that. But some guy at a bus stop who's watching you is far more real to you than God will ever be. He's not talking about madrigas and Yiras Shemayim. The madrigas and Yiras Shemayim are far greater to God than they are to some guy at a bus stop, except how seriously do you take them? There's no comparison. No comparison. You take God far less seriously than you do anyone who's watching you. Jew, guy, child, adult. You know? So that's how you develop relationships, by opening up to people. You know? Making it real. Then you'll eventually start being honest. And if you're honest with people, then you might become eventually honest with God. And until then, when you're quote-unquote honest, oh, I tell God everything. Yes, I have no secrets between me and God. We're a team, and I have no secrets to him. But if there's not a single person on this planet who you can open up to, that means that you don't take God as seriously as that person. That's why he can conveniently be open to God, because, you know, he doesn't matter to you, because he's just a concept. He's not real. This is an important, essential thing to realize. This is why God gives community to human beings. This is why we daven in a minyan. This is why we have other people in Klal Yisrael. You're supposed to say Bishvili Nivra Olam, Lama Nivra Adam Yachid, so that everyone is chayav to say to himself Bishvili Nivra Olam. So the question is, why Lo Tov Heyosa Adam Levado? Why is it Lo Tov Heyosa Adam Levado? You know why? Why does the Gemara say O Chavrusa O Misusa? Sounds like what's that American guy? Give me friends or give me death. You know, by the way, that Gemara, O Chavrusa, O Misusa, I think it's in Tinus, this person woke up after so many years. He had no friends. He had no one that he could relate to. And he said, O Chavrusa, O Misusa, or maybe it was Rabbi Yochanan, who after Reish Lakish died, he had no one to learn with who could understand him. And he felt so alone. He had no friends. And he said, you know, one of them it was, I don't remember. He says, O Chavrusa, O Misusa, if I have no friends, then how can I live? And the Chachamim daven that he should die, and he died. You know, this is not about assisted suicide. it's true. You can't really live without friends. But here we are, sex addicts, lust addicts, and the one person who we get naked in front of is some webcam girl or some naked magazine or pornography that you're looking at, and that's the one that you're getting all naked and masturbating to, and it's a whole secret life. And you don't tell anyone, but I tell God, because he sees me. Well, he also sees you going to the bathroom. Like, you have no shame in front of him when you go to the bathroom. That means you have no shame in front of him, because he's not real to you, because you're not real. Try going to the bathroom not in front of Chas V'Shalom, but with another person in the room. It's sometimes difficult, you know? I work in healthcare, and sometimes I have a person who, the nurse is in the room with this person. He can't urinate until they can. You please leave the room, you know. It's like, oh, but you can do it in front of God. Why? Because he's not really there for you. It's not that you're on a low level of emuna. You're a human being, and this is the way it is. You understand the point I'm trying to make? I'm not putting anyone down. This applies to everyone, including Tanoim, the Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So if you want the program to work, you need a God of your very own. That's the whole point. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, that's the result of the 12 steps. Having a God of your very own. Ani ledodi vidodi li. You know? If you can somehow quiet the cute child down a little bit, or maybe mute your phone, that would be just fabulous. If you can. Thank you. So that having a God of your very own is not just believing that a God exists. If you talk to the average heathen in AA, you know, you can sometimes hear an emuna that is far more real than anything you've ever heard in yeshiva from anyone. Sometimes. Why is that? How is that? This is a house of God. It's a yeshiva. Rav Noach Weinberg would always say, you want to learn about God, come to yeshiva. You know, if you walk into the average yeshiva and you ask somebody how to put on tefillin,
there are 50 guys who will help you put on tefillin. But if you walk into yeshiva and you ask, can somebody here tell me how exactly do I love God? The Rambam says you're supposed to love God like you love a woman. You can't get her out of your mind. You're crazy about her all day long. Teach me how to love God. A few guys maybe will come over to you sheepishly and tell you something like, you know, they'll open up a sefer maybe and they'll, you know, let's learn the sefer about loving God. I'm like, well, with the tefillin, you just showed me. Show me how you love God. How do you love God? How do you love God? You know, it's not the easiest, simplest conversation you're going to have in yeshiva with people who are, quote unquote, learning about God. Why? Because most of the people learn about God in a very indirect way in yeshiva, and they're learning about Shnayim Mochus and Vitalis, which is God's will, and indirectly they're learning about God, which is fine. But that's not enough for a sexaholic whose God is this naked lady or naked guy in a pornography magazine or on a pornography website performing sex acts, and you're drawn to it like you're drawn to God, like it says, Acharei Hashem Elokeichem Telechu, Vososiro Uvosid Bakun, that you run after him. You're supposed to follow a Sefer Torah in a shul, and some people say that pasuk, because you're supposed to cling to God, to go after him. And not just God even, his Torah is walking through the shul. You're supposed to want to walk after it. I want to follow you wherever you may go, as the song says. You know? That's what it's supposed to be. And that's what any from guy or from girl who's looking at pornography and taking furtive glance, you're struggling to get it. You're not struggling against it. I mean, you might be struggling against it too, but look at all the measures that you do and the risks that you take. It's obviously precious to you. And I'm not putting anyone down. This is what it means to be like me. I'm a sexologist. This is what it means. That the pornography and the schmutz and the fantasy are so precious to us that we even risk getting caught by our spouses. And we still do it. And you excuse yourself and you say, oh, we excuse ourselves and we say, well, no, it's against me, and I'm trying not to, and I'm wishing that I wouldn't, and this. But you're taking tremendous risks, and you're doing it anyway at tremendous risk to yourself. That's mesiras nefesh. You don't see that? You don't see how precious it is to you? Well, how precious is God to you? Well, I go to shul, even though it's a pain in the neck. I'm sorry, there's something missing here, you know? Do you hear me? There's something missing here, and I'm not talking about madrigas. I'm talking about how do we get that? How do we desire a relationship with our own God who's realer to me than a person and more important to me and that it helps me actually function and that I don't need the naked stuff because I got God. How do you do that? Like all the alcoholic goyim do and you're from Yidda. How do you do that? By opening up another Musa Sefer? It's not going to work. You've been opening up Musa's firm your whole life, and here you are on this call with me. What's going on? What do you need? Well, you need the building blocks for real honest relationships with people. Stop having secrets to everyone. Find someone or some group with whom you can actually be friends, totally honest, vulnerable about everything, without hiding from that person anything for shame, anything. If you go to an SA meeting and you can't open up to the SA meeting itself that you relapsed, or that you feel you're going to relapse again, and you know you're going to relapse again, and there's nothing anyone can do to stop you, then you don't have an honest relationship with that group. Then you're not an SA. You're in another room. And you happen to be sticking your foot into this meeting. You're not in the program in the fashion that you need to be if you want this stuff to really be real, because you're not going to get a relationship with God that way. And the reason you don't have a relationship with God is because you don't have a relationship with people yet, an adequate relationship with people. And the way to get a relationship with people is to find safe people. And for God's sake, You found a bunch of sexaholics, and you're still not safe with them? Safe enough to admit your vulnerabilities? Oh, I can admit that I masturbate to them, but I can't admit how jealous I am of my brother that he has a wife who looks 50 times better than my wife, and I lust after her, and I can't stand it anymore. And I think about it every Shabbos that we get together and every family simcha, and it's driving me out of my mind. You can't admit that to your SA group? You can't admit that to your SA? Well, that's too embarrassing. Oh, but that you masturbate isn't so embarrassing. Yeah, because everybody else says that. Ah, now you see what's going on. Opening up truly about yourself is too hard because you don't trust them. Well, if there's no trust with any people, trust me, you don't have trust with God either. You don't trust him either. Promise. Guaranteed. It's lip service. It's lip service. The davening, this, that, as far as a mitzvah goes, it's a mitzvah. 100%. You're doing a mitzvah of davening. You're doing a mitzvah of whatever else. It's still a mitzvah. It's still beautiful. It still has tremendous value. But it's not living with God that the AA SA program is all about, to me. That's belief in God is not enough for an addict. You got to learn how to live with God, and that comes from learning how to live with people. That doesn't mean you have to clap on the bima and be open and honest with everybody in your shul. That's not going to help you, because they don't understand what you're talking about, and half of them are doing it themselves, maybe, and I'm sure some are, you know, but a good number of them are doing it themselves, and chances are they're going to be the first ones who are going to vilify you and blacklist you for opening up in public, because kol haposel, the mumo posel, the Gemara says. You're most afraid of those who have the same deficits that you have. That's the way a person is. That's the way I am. That's the way everybody is. So how do you open up? Well, open up. That's how you open up, by practicing open up. How do you do anything right? By practicing doing it. You know, how do you love? By practicing loving. You take actions of love. You know, the Gemara says, V'ahavtas Hashem, looking, how do you love Hashem? Well, you do this, you do that, you do that. But love is just an action? Yes, it's an action, but it's not only an action. It comes from taking actions. So you practice loving. That's how you love, by practicing loving. So how do you become open and honest? How do you become trusting? By practicing trusting. You know, and if any of you open up about the truth about yourselves in an SA meeting, and then the next thing you know, it's all around town, please call me and let me know. Because that can't be possible, because there's, you know, I'm not going to mention the Jewish community on this call because it's an open call, but you name your large Jewish community, there's 50 guys there probably, and some gals too, or maybe 200, who are going to these meetings and doing these things and opening up 100% with each other about everything, and yet the next day they come back again. Because why? Because they weren't exposed in the community yet, right? And these meetings have been going on for 20 years in some of these cities, or longer, with 100, upwards of 100, from Kolo guys, Mechanchim, well-known Askanim in the community, businessmen, or coming to these meetings, and women also in many of the cases, coming to these meetings. You know, there are men's meetings too. Don't worry if you're not comfortable with women, or, you know, there are also women's only meetings. If you're not comfortable with men there, don't worry about it. But you know, let's, you know, you're safe, okay? You're safe. So that, you know, usually people go in and out of the program because they're not opening up fully to the meeting, and they don't really fully trust the meeting, and they think, and they usually know it in some way. So they disappear when they act out. They disappear, and they appear when they're clean. And that's not that's not how you move in life in anything, and that's not how entrepreneurs succeed. You know, people say that if you start a new business, most new businesses fail. In fact, if you look at the statistics, there's a great book, Startup Nation. Take a look at it. It's about Israel as an entrepreneurial country. It's a pretty funny book, too. But, you know, in all of these entrepreneurial books, they talk about the fact that the overwhelming majority of startups fail. Well, then why are there so many startups? And why is it that that very often they say people, it's like the third or fourth business that they start that actually succeeds? How did they have the gumption to start three businesses and the fourth one works if they all failed? Why didn't they say, well, I guess I'm going to leave, you know? So, like, why? Because they never left the room. They stayed honest, open with themselves through the whole process of failure. You know, you practice success by trying and trying and practicing, you know? They say that try again. You know, if at first you don't succeed, try again. That is not a great motto for skydiving, right? You know, that's what people say. But recovery is not like skydiving. I'm sorry. Recovery is like growing up. How does an adolescent grow up? By succeeding from day one or by repeated failure? How did you learn how to walk? By falling on your butt over and over and over? Or by getting up and just walking? No, the first way. You learn by trying. And the failure isn't the most important thing necessarily, but it's an unavoidable necessary condition to success. So if you're trying in program, if you're going to meetings, like the person who asked me this question, he goes to meetings and he asked me this question. If you're going to meetings and you're failing at staying sober, that's not a reason to quit going to meetings by itself. That's a reason to get more honest, because chances are you're not being honest in the meetings or with the people. If you can't trust them for specific reasons, so then by all means, tell them so. Tell them, I feel that it's, and I think it's obvious, that I can't trust you all because of reason X, Y, and Z. They're not going to throw you out. They're going to discuss it with you. There might be a baby in the room who's going to throw you out, who's going to say, oh, well, you don't belong here, blah, blah, blah. There might be one guy, but trust me, out of the 15 other people there, the other 14 are going to say, excuse me, you're out of your mind. This guy is being honest with his feelings. And by the way, I've never seen anybody get ostracized by a group by admitting that they're scared of that they're intimidated or scared by the members, because I did it myself. I was coming to SA for over a year, maybe it was 2 years or so already, and sharing in the same group, and I would share almost every meeting, because my sponsor said to me, it's really important to share every meeting, even if it's a short share, try to get current about what's going on with you, and that's what I would do, and I thought about what I said before, and I thought about what I said after, and I thought about what people thought about what I said, and my sponsor, And I didn't know what to do. And intuitively, I don't remember if someone told me to, if my sponsor told me to, but I knew it's time for me to open up. If I'm having a hard time opening up and just relaxing and just letting the truth come out because I'm thinking too much in this group, then it's time for me to admit that. And that's what I did. And I used my time and my share to my 2 or 3 minutes, you know, to say, you know, I love this group. It's great that I keep coming back, but I'm intimidating by you. I'm intimidated by the group, and I'm afraid to really share what's going on in my head because I have this fear that I'm going to get thrown out if I tell the whole truth. Now, I know that's not really going to happen, but that's my fear. That's my suspicion. You know, that's a level of honesty that I never heard such honesty before. Well, that's what recovery is. You know, welcome to the group. You're being honest. Welcome to the group. You know, now you're in the group because you admitted that you don't feel safe in the group. Until you admitted that, you weren't in the group. You were somewhere else. It's paradoxical, and that's how it works. You know? It's like V-Day. It's like, how does V-Day work? You know, saying your sins, how does that help you? You know, saying your sins, admitting your sins, how does that help you? It's sinning. It's saying sins. How does that mean? You know, it's paradoxical, but it works. You know, the Ikra Mitzvah, you know, the Rambam says vidui. It's not, you know, you've got to do vidui. That's it. it's not azivas achet, that's not the ikar mitzvah of tshuva. Really, it's vidui. How can that be? You know, look in the Rambam. Anyway, anyway, getting back to the thing. So, how do I stop yo-yoing in the program? I'm going to go on another shlav now. A lot of people yo-yo in the program because, and I'm not talking about GYE. GYE is not a program and has no program. GYE, as Bard keeps reminding me, is not a program of recovery. GYE is a group of people who admit their problems to try to find some aces of, you know, what to do. And some people end up in programs, some people end up in recovery, in 12-step programs, I mean. And some people end up in therapy, some people do various, techniques, they like to call them, whatever, that are available on the website to try to hold yourself back or whatever. And those who are addicts obviously, you know, need some kind of change, and they're never going to change by just holding themselves back forever. You're just going to explode eventually. So why bother going down that path, and, you know, with trust that that's all you need if it's not true. So that's my job, to remind people of that. because that's what works for me, because that's what I need. So I share my experience. Anyhow, so then joining a program, many people come and they're, you know, this guy who's asking is a person who's in a 12-step recovery program, and he keeps relapsing. So the first thing I said to him was, the first thing I responded was, you haven't had enough pain yet, obviously, and you haven't had enough pleasure yet in being sober and doing the recovery work. So those are the two basic things that everybody needs. Pain and pleasure are what motivates us. The other thing, so obviously work your program better, which I focus on. How do you work the program better? I focused until now in this talk, past half hour or so, on relationships, on realifying, making your relationships real by complete vulnerability and total honesty, which is something that you do not have the capacity to do. So you will probably learn how to do that only by practicing it. And it will take a few months of consistent repetition of being honest, being open. Open and honest are not the same. Okay? I can be honest by not telling any lies. That's not openness. Openness means that I don't tell any lies, but I also tell everything. Okay? So that's open. And that's what's necessary, you know? And if you feel like that's an intrusion, then obviously the program's not for you, because that's the three legs the program stands on. Well, there's another three legs of service, but honesty, openness, and willingness are the three keys to the program that people say who are in various programs. If that's what you want, if you want what the program has to offer, the people in the program seem to agree that you need honesty, openness, and willingness. And pain brings about the willingness, usually. And the pleasure of waking up sober and going to sleep sober is enough in itself to provide enough pleasure to say, yes, this is worthwhile. Because along with it comes so many other things, like serenity. And when you have honest relationships, the relationships are real relationships. And there's no substitute for that. There's no substitute for honest, real relationships. Okay, so anyway, getting back to the thingy, Bob. So I'm not speaking for SA now. I'm just sharing my experience. Okay, this is not an SA call. This is not an AA call. I'm not a member of AA, but this is not an AA or an SA call. This is a GYE call, and I hope people understand that if they're listening. The other element over here is that a lot of people are in the program. They are, you know, the reason that I went on the Shlav until now is because the person who asked the question explained that their experience in the program is they come and then they go. They actually leave the rooms. They actually stop coming to meetings. They actually ebb in their relationships with others in the program become less robust and more superficial, and then they kind of isolate, you know, or go out of the program back into themselves, back into their own, you know, corner that they came from in the first place, and then eventually they act out a lot, and then they come back and you know, into the program when the pain gets enough. So being motivated by pain that way is not working for them, and they say, hey, I thought pain is supposed to motivate me, and I keep coming back to the program when it hurts enough. Well, it hurts, you know, that means that you're not ready for recovery, because there's something in the program where you're willing to stay in the program to some point, and then when things get too embarrassing to admit, that's probably why you're leaving. Because it's very hard to admit when you're sober that you're thinking of acting out, because you want to look, everybody wants to look good. I want to look good. You know, I don't want to admit my weaknesses and foibles to you. I want you to think that I'm strong and this and that, you know, but I'm powerless over lust. I can't use lust successfully. You know, I'm like an alcoholic who can't use alcohol successfully. I can't use lust, you know, successfully. So that doesn't mean I can't have sex with my wife, but you know, this is a whole different story. This is lust. I'm talking about lusting. You know, the guys who are having a hard time, you know, and can't stay sober, they haven't hit bottom yet, which means they haven't had enough pain yet. And that's pretty obvious. Or they're not addicts in the first place. Let them go to psychologists and learn some techniques, and maybe they'll stay sober without anything else because they're not addicts in the first place. A lot of guys have been brainwashed by information that they read on Guard Your Eyes that implies to them that they're addicts, that you're always an addict if you do X, Y, and Z, and that's it. And not only that, but you're forever going to be an addict, because once an addict, always an addict. And you really, you know, it's a crazy combination of lies that come together in some places that I've read, on Guard Your Eyes, and also in program, people are misled as well by things that people tell them. But if you open up the big book of AA or the SA white book, you will not find people trying to convince you that you're an addict. You will find people sharing their experience and saying, if you think you're one of us, so then we have a solution that works for us. If you want it, come and get it. You know, and nobody's going to police you and call you up. Where did you go? Why aren't you coming back? Come back, please. Nobody's going to do that to you in any 12-step program that I've ever seen. You know, anyway, all right. Let me do one more little piece on this, and then I'm going to split. The last thing, I just want to say that there are probably many other reasons why people relapse. I just haven't had enough lust yet is one good reason, right? A lot of people, they're like, well, I just haven't finished acting out yet. You know, I still need some more. My sponsor would say that to me when I got curious and started messing around with lust. He would say to me, Catholic guy named Jeff Dove, you haven't had enough yet, have you? You know, and he loved me, and he would say that to me in a loving way, not in a pejorative way. You know, you haven't had enough yet, have you? You know, I can't make you have enough. Obviously, you've either had enough or you haven't. You know, and I had suffered significantly. Trust me, I'm not going into that on this call. But, anyway, so that's a biggie. The other thing is trust. which is the other biggie, the lack of trust and the unwillingness to practice trusting for whatever reason. Another thing is not working the steps. If a person is not working the steps, chances are they're going to lose their sobriety, because the alcoholics have discovered, look, if you look at the steps, you'll see nothing is in there about self-control, preventing yourself from acting out, all that stuff. Alcohol is not mentioned in the 12 steps anywhere, except in the beginning as a qualifier, and that's it. The entire rest of the 12 steps mention not a single thing about controlling alcohol or fighting drinking or not drinking or sobriety or anything. It's not even mentioned, because that's not the point. It's about serenity, acceptance, connection with God and people, acceptance of life on life's terms, which means God's will for me. Who my wife is God's will for me right now. How fat I am is God's will for me right now. You're not going to lose 82 pounds today. Okay? So, you know, you're not going to get a new husband today. You're not going to get new kids today. You're not going to get a new job today. So the situation that you're in right now is clearly God's will for me. And how do I relate to that? Do I work on, you know, help me have the God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, because there are a lot of things I can change, but I need the wisdom to know the difference. Because if I don't know the difference between them, and I think that I can change things that I really can't change, or that I can change things today that I can't change today at all, I can slowly work on changing them over time, but they're not changing today. If I don't know the difference between those two categories, it's very likely I'm going to live in a state of continual disappointment and frustration. And, the 12 steps, if you look at them carefully, and of course, if you work them, you'll see that's the point of them is a life with a God of your very own, a faith that works, as opposed to just faith for the religion's sake. That's not in the program, and that's why the program's not a religion. And it's not religious, it doesn't get in the way of religion, and it doesn't necessarily foster religion. If you want to be religious, it'll help you, but it doesn't tell you to be religious. It tells you to have, not just to have a God, but to have a God of your very own. That's the point. And it doesn't mess with who your God is or what your idea of God is at all. Doesn't deal with that, because it's irrelevant to the program, as far as I'm aware. And I don't speak for the program. Again, I'm speaking from my own experience. So the 12 steps allow a person to stay in life, in this life, with the people that they're in, to accept themselves as they are, to accept life as they are, not necessarily to become complacent and not want to change anything. No, you might want to change lots of things and grow in lots of ways, but if you can't accept the facts, then you're not going to get very far. It's the example, the mushal I give is usually of the person with an amputated leg. There are two kinds of people who have an amputated leg. They're one-legged people. There are two kinds. Those who have accepted it fully, and those who haven't accepted it fully. Those who have accepted it fully can have a happy life. Those who have not accepted it fully will have a very hard time having a happy life, because they're always going to be thinking, "Ugh, I only have one leg. That's so frustrating. I hate it. Maybe it'll grow back. I have to hide it from everyone. I really should have another leg. I really should have two legs just like him. Why do I only have, I only have one leg." Yeah, that's not acceptance. That's bargaining. They're still in the stage of bargaining of that woman, whatever her name was, that great person who looked about the stages of dying, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. They're in the stage of bargaining still, or anger. They accept the facts because they look at it and there it is, but that's not acceptance. And acceptance doesn't mean jumping for joy. Yay, I lost my leg, hooray! You know, that's not what it means either. it's something else. It's an acceptance of the fact, a complete acceptance of the fact. A person who has completely accepted the facts accepts themselves. That's really the gift of the program. That's one of the gifts of the program, is acceptance. And it's a beautiful story if you want to read about acceptance is the answer or acceptance is the key. It's a beautiful story in the back of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, where they have member stories, about 250 pages at least of member stories. Great stuff. One of them is the famous story, well-known story, called Acceptance Was the Answer or something like that. And I think they changed the name and they're between the third and fourth edition, but anyhow, that's a great story, and if you look at that story, you'll see what I'm talking about as far as acceptance is concerned. And that's one of the fruits of the steps, is this full acceptance of the truths in my life. And that allows a person to be at peace. If you have full acceptance, then you can be at peace with your life. If you're not at peace with your life, then you're probably also not at peace with yourself. You're probably not at peace with God, really. And you're probably not at peace. I'm not ready to go. I'm not ready to go, honey. Okay, sweetheart, I'll come to you when I'm ready, though. I thought that was the message, dear. Okay, it's all right. Yeah, my daughter's taking me to work. But anyway, she's great. I just want to finish up, and then we can, and then I'm going to leave. But I'm going to finish up in a minute or two. So the acceptance of things brings a peace to a person and allows them to have the power to really succeed and grow. Rav Dessler talks about this concept a little bit, very indirectly, in his Chibur HaChesed or something like that he wrote. It's in Chelek Aleph of Michtav Meliyahu, and the second part of it is in another Chelek, I forget which one, of Michtav Meliyahu. And it's a treatise on Chesed that he wrote. It's in the English translation of Strive for Truth, of course. And in there he asks a question. He says, he talks about this idea of love and giving as opposed to taking. And he says, well, if we're all about love and giving, which is obviously born of an attitude where you accept life and you're not demanding, you're accepting. So then we don't take from life, we just accept from life. So then how do you have any ambition whatsoever? And how do you change and grow in any way? So don't you become like a blob, you know, and passive kind of weird kind of human being? Like what's, you know? So Rav Dessler addresses this very beautifully over there. So it's a similar idea. I'm just referring you there. So the program really, when a person is doing it right, becomes a powerhouse of growth, as opposed to like laying down and dying. It's a powerhouse of growth. It's like you're plugging yourself into a nuclear reactor. That's what it is, of change and growth. So if you're having... if you're yo-yoing in the program and stuff, so then you're probably not plugged in. You know, you're probably just sitting there without plugging yourself in. So again, I would suggest highly plug yourself into it. You know, you don't have to be afraid. And if you are afraid, admit you're afraid to the group. Admit you're afraid to yourself, to the group. You know. And when you admit it to the group, you'll see your own admission to yourself will have changed. Inside, you yourself understand your own fear differently. And when you say, I'm afraid, you will be admitting it to yourself more than before, which is important. You won't have more fear, you'll have less fear as a result of doing that. You know, and as far as like self-control and all that stuff, that's not what the program's about. But Of course, if a person doesn't work the steps, they won't be able to stay sober because they lack peace. You know, if you lack peace, you're like that squirrel running on the thing, searching, I'm searching. And this is how a lot of people come to the program. I'm going to end with this, says Hashem. A lot of people come to the program like spiritual rats on a wheel. It's like, oh, I got to find the answer. Where's the answer? I need the answer.
Exactly. Am I going to listen to this schmooze? Am I going to listen to that talk? Am I going to listen to him? Am I going to listen to them? Here's a big name. Let me listen to him. He'll tell me the answer. Let me do this. Let me go say the Tikkun HaKloli. He'll give me the answer. Let me go to the mikveh again. Let me do this. Let me do that. It's like a frantic neediness, and it's under the surface. It's under the surface. It's another self-help book. Another self-help book. And it's like, my God, just calm down. You know, God's with you right now. You know, there are tools in the 12 steps to do that, to become calm over time by going through a process one step at a time, slowly, with an or quickly, doesn't matter, with another person. And there's no escape. There's no rushing it. There's no, you know, it's just relax. You're going to be fine. Go through these steps. Stay clean. Go through these steps. Give it 6 months, okay? Take 6 months. You're not going to masturbate for 6 months. You're not. Your penis isn't going to fall off. You're not going to explode. You're not going to die. Just relax, you know? Join with these other guys. You've done it before. You've been clean for this amount of time before. And then just go one day at a time. Don't worry about it. And work these steps and watch yourself change. Watch your peace grow. Watch yourself change into the kind of person who life is different now, and I don't need to act out right now to feel good. I don't need that right now. And that's what the steps are really about. The steps don't get you sober, but they allow you to stay sober. So that's the third shtickle, which is of my suggestions, which is work the steps. If you're not yet, work them, you know. Don't talk about them and study them. Work them. Reading the literature is very, very inspiring. I would highly recommend reading member stories in the back of the book. Highly recommend it. And reading the first, you know, six chapters of the book, especially chapter 5. Hatzlacha. Bye-bye. Hope that was helpful. Any comments before I sign off? Okay. All right. All the best. I'm going to stop the recording section.